This is David Bruckner, director of The Ritual, and you are listening to The Grindhouse Messiah.
Hey everyone, this is Justin. I'm just checking in before the podcast to give you guys a few little updates. First, if you're new to the podcast, thanks for joining us. If you've come here from some other feed over here at Farsighted Blog, again, we appreciate you checking us out. In addition to us, there's a whole bunch of podcasts on the network, including some new ones, so check out PS Midnight Cast, Victims and Villains, the Post-Traumatic Church Disorder. Those are all brand new to the feed. Check those folks out, and always give some love to Uncle Eddie's mixtapes, and there's even more to come. Before I turn this over, I just want to give a quick shout out to the Chattanooga Film Festival we're going to be covering real soon. We should have a brief little chat with one of the programmers of the festival before the next episode. Hopefully you'll hear that with our episode with Miss McKendry and Mr. McKendry, that you might know as Rebecca McKendry of Fangoria and Shockwave Podcast and Blumhouse and a bunch of other stuff, and her husband David McKendry, who is just an awesome dude in his own right, exploitation film nerd, so he is excited to chit chat about some exploitation. They've got a film coming out that's going to be playing Chattanooga, making its premiere there. So we're going to hopefully have a little bit about that. And one of the other films playing Chattanooga is Mohawk by Ted Gagan, who is one of the guests today. So we hope you enjoy this episode, and I hope you enjoy that next upcoming episode and another upcoming episode that we have coming up with Greg Travis, actor and filmmaker that you might know from things like Showgirls, Shakes the Clown, or, well, a whole lot of stuff. The guy's been doing films since Humanoids in the Deep in the early 60s, and just keeps going and going and going. Awesome guy. We're excited to have him on. So those are all coming up in the next couple weeks. Daniel Francesi is going to be on, as in, you know, the gay best friend in Mean Girls. So I might even try to get him to say, "She doesn't even go here," or something like that. I probably won't get him to do that, because I'm a loser. That was a dumb joke. All right, without any further ado, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you next week.
Picture this, I'm a bag of dicks, put me to your lips, I am sick, I will punch a baby bear in his shit, give me lip, I'ma send you to the yard, get a stick, make a switch, I can end the conversation real quick, I am crack, I ain't lying, kick a lion in his crack, I'm the shit, I will fall off in your crib, take a shit, hit your mama on the booty, kick your dog, fuck your bitch, fat boy dressed up like he's down on and took pictures with your kids, we the best, we will cut a frowny face in your chest, little wench, I'm a mentionably fresh, I'm a man. Get correct, I will walk into a court while it wrecks, screaming, yes, I am guilty, motherfuckers, I am death. Hey, you wanna hear a good joke? Nobody speak, nobody get choked.
Hi, this is David Howard Thornton, also known as Art the Clown in the movie Terrifier, and you are listening to Grindhouse Messiah.
Who flame throw your fuck shit to Funyuns? Flame your crew quicker than Trump fucks his youngest. Now face the flame fuckers, your fame and fate's done with.
I walk Charlie Brown, Peppermint, Patty, Linus, and Lucy. Put dope in the doobie, roll woolies to smoke with Snoopy. I still remain that dick rabbit slacker to spit a wookie. Cause the total of the toolie will murder you friggin' moolies.
Fuck outta here.
Welcome everybody back to another episode of Grindhouse Messiah. This is once again your co-host Blaine, and with me, as always, is my good friend Justin.
Yes, well, good friend. A little behind the curtains. We are good friends, and I would definitely say that. But you know, Blaine and I have never actually met physically in real life.
Not in one fucking time.
Yeah, not once. We will this year, thankfully. But yeah. So with that, thanks a lot for coming on
to join us this week. We have some awesome guests, but before we get to them, let's give a quick word to our sponsors. Blaine, who are our sponsors again? Not like I don't know, but you're like the biggest fan I know of this company, yes. So I'm going to let you say something.
Our sponsor is my favorite of these boutique distributors, and that is Vinegar Syndrome. Last episode, or the episode before last, we talked about half of the most recent box we got. But the other half, I mean, I finally got a chance to check out, which I had never seen either of the films. One being 1995's Ice Cream Man, which was a lot of fun to finally watch. Clint Howard being super fucking weird. Lots of, like, foxy, flat butt 90s women. I mean, a lot of fun. I know you'd been a big fan of this one for a long time and always brought it up.
I rented it, I think, 15 times in college because there was no way to buy it at the time that I could find. So I just kept renting it from Blockbuster, hoping that they would just let me keep it one day. I'm a big fan of this movie. And I love the Vinegar Syndrome release for sure. I named it as one of my favorites of the year because they actually put this out in the December package, but we actually kind of got some of the December stuff with the January stuff to look at this month, and we finally got around to, you know, checking that out. But yeah. I'm a big fan of that movie as well. And what did you appreciate that one?
I liked it. I'm glad I've seen it. Like, I'm glad I've seen it. It's got a lot of fun stuff. It's super. Like, it's when it's good, it's great. When it's boring, it's a little long to watch. But in other news, I got to watch fucking Lucifer's Women, which was a film that was put out by Paul Arital, the director of Silk China, China Girl. I'm getting confused with my old man pornos that I love. But this was super fucking weird. I had seen part of the Alan the Al Adamson release of it under the name of I believe it was Blood of Dracula, which was super terrible, as most of Al Adamson's movies are. You know, even Poor Nurse Sherry, which is so bad. But this movie was super strange, like pretty light on gore and everything, but like a really good, like, kind of black magic occult film. Lots of really strange sex scenes. I know the big deal about it was that Anton LaVey helped out with a lot of the black mass stuff, but this was definitely the more interesting of the two. Maybe not as well made of a film, but really interesting, like in a fun, you know, thing that I'd never seen. Have you checked it out yet?
No, that's the one I haven't gotten to. So unfortunately, I don't really have anything to add about that. But I am stoked to check that one out, and we'll be coming back into next episode to talk about the stuff that from the February package. So we'll have the sequel to Penitentiary, Penitentiary 2, which we talked a little bit about, and Prey, and I guess might be able to check out Mary Mary as well. And so we'll see how the February package kind of reins in. But before we take up all our time, which, you know, Vinegar Syndrome does deserve a lot of time because they're awesome, we also have some awesome guests that we want to actually spend a good amount of time with this episode. And I'm going to go ahead and let our first guest, a certain director, introduce himself. So, Ted, take it away.
Hey, how's it going? This is Ted Gagan. I'm the writer and director of We Are Still Here and Mohawk.
And with us as well is another person involved in that movie who I don't know what's your official title? You're the special effects.
Yeah,
that's what I keep calling you.
I guess.
take it away, Marcus.
Okay, I'm Marcus Cook. I mainly do special effects. I've worked with Ted now for a good many years, since I think maybe 2002. Yeah, Ted and I have been friends for a very long time. Worked on projects that he's written, I've done effects for, and now he's directing, and he brings me along for the ride for some effects for his films.
Oh, very cool. Ted's worked on some of your projects as well?
Yeah. We killed him in 100 Tears, my cheesy killer clown film, a lot of blood, and he's one of the associate producers, and so, yeah, Ted and I go back a long time.
We sure do.
No, that's also having both of you guys, because I know I've talked to Marcus about it, and this is the first time speaking with you, Ted, but I've been a big fan of both of yours work. I mean, between We Are Still Here. We'll get into Mohawk a little bit later, but also, Marcus, with some of the films you've made between your entry in the American Guinea Pig saga, we'll call it, with Bloodshock, yeah. as well as, you know, your earlier films like Rot, 100 Tears, and also my favorite, which came out on Brain Damage Films, called Fell, which to me is by far one of my favorite, you know, kind of in that kind of line of
my non-horror.
But
it's non-horror, but it's bleak and depressing. It's you know, hands down one of my favorite things, but no one's ever seen it. You know, I wish more people would watch it, but I think because it doesn't have tons of gore in it, like, you know, because then people could see that, hey, I'm more than just a gore guy.
Right, and if listeners out there, if you are interested, it is available to watch for free on YouTube through the Brain Damage channel, so check it out and give it a good chance. But yeah, with that said,
actually, I think it's the company is Chemical Burn.
On par. Okay. No disrespect to the Scarlet Fry and the good people at Chemical Burn, or I don't know, all those companies get mixed up in my head. So rewind that. Hey, Justin, edit that out. I know you won't.
Edit that out. I'm gonna leave that right there. Yep.
So go to Chemical Burn on their YouTube channel, and you can watch Fell for free. But I mean, but that said, we're here to kind of celebrate the release of Mohawk with Ted Gagan, and he ended up picking out a few of his films that he wanted to discuss in some sort of relevancy. To the making of his film and just stuff he wanted to talk about. Ted, what films did you pick out for us?
I picked out 1977's Rituals, an amazing Canadian, I guess you'd say a proto-slasher, made before slashers were really a thing, but has a lot of relevance and a lot of weight, especially in considering how it affects Mohawk, and John Borman's The Emerald Forest, which visually was a major inspiration for Mohawk.
Well, the first film we're going to talk about tonight is Rituals. So, Justin, why don't you tell us about this movie, and we'll kind of roll into it that way.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise.
This animal has only been dead for a couple of hours.
Look, Harry, somebody's playing a very sick game with us, and I want to know who, and I want to know why.
If you go down in the woods today, you better go in disguise.
Ah! April's dead, Harry.
Was it a man?
Or every man that ever knew us would gather there for
We're in the middle of nowhere, Mitzi. No one's gonna help us.
Why? Why is it happening to us?
Somebody has stolen that boots.
Why would anyone steal five pairs of boots?
Get off it, DJ.
Look, 2 months ago, I sent everyone Xerox sheets of what I would supply and what you were to bring. You were to bring extra shoes and your toothbrushes. I supplied everything else.
Five doctors on their annual ritual, just trying to have a good time. But this is the year they should have stayed at home.
That thing's never gonna let us out of here!
Rituals isn't a picnic. You're in for a big surprise.
Yeah, so Rituals is from 1977, I believe. Yes, I'm double-checking before I say that. And my IMDb skills are a little slow tonight. So it's also called The Creeper, which I actually think might be a better name, in my opinion, for what the film's about. What were you saying?
I think it's a giveaway.
Yeah, that's fair. Maybe it's too much of a giveaway. Okay. Five doctors go on vacation deep in the Canadian wilderness after all but one pair of the party shoes disappear, which I think is a pretty awesome, weird moment for everything to kind of kick off. And then the remaining shoed camper decides he's going to hike out and go look for help. Soon after he leaves, however, the four companions realize that something is very wrong when someone leaves like a decapitated deer head just outside their camp. Even though they still don't have their shoes, they decide they have to follow their friend's trail out of the woods. But their path is blocked by someone or something that doesn't want them to leave the forest alive. So, Ted, you picked this movie. Let's just start with, you're a big fan of this movie. What makes you love this film?
It's the type of film that I think all too often gets overlooked by cinephiles, especially people within the industry. It is a beautifully, beautifully shot film. It's the type of movie that if you released it right now without any changes, it could make a ton of money because it's virtually timeless in its storytelling. Modern slasher films, modern horror films, suspense films, like, oh, this film's such a huge debt of gratitude just in terms of how it plays out suspense and terror, especially in the woods. The director of it, Peter Carter, was a British guy, moved to Canada, made a ton of films, and died shortly after making Rituals. He wasn't too old. I think he was only in his 50s when he died. Made some action films, made a couple comedies. But I think Rituals is by far the high point of his career. I just think it's overall, it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous movie, and it's got an amazing cast. I'm a big fan of films that employ older actors, or as I guess they say in the industry, actors of a certain age. Hal Holbrook's the lead in the film, and he's absolutely phenomenal. He made this film a few years before he made what I consider one of the greatest horror films of all time, John Carpenter's The Fog. I realize he has a supporting role in it, but it's so important. And it just overall, I think it's a masterful piece of cinema that people tend to forget. Canada was very integral in the birth of the slasher genre. And I think this film really cements it for them.
No, absolutely. And when I started watching this film, at first I kept starting to watch it late at night and kept kind of, I don't know, not as much that I wasn't enjoying the film, but I just kept starting. I was way too tired. I finally got a chance. I started back from the very beginning today, made sure to get home from work a little early, and started watching because at first I was a little bit cold on it. I was really enjoying, you know, all those, you know, nice wide, you know, shots, like nature shots throughout the beginning. But just kind of wade my way through watching Hal Holbrook do what he does best, you know, just watching those guys transform. It really grew on me as we went along in the film. And not to give anything away, but going into that last 20 minutes, it finally kind of clicked with me why you picked this movie. Because
It is dreadfully nihilistic, intense horror in the last 20 minutes of the film. And while I don't think that that's quite the angle we decided to take Mohawk in terms of its nihilism, it certainly makes itself known. I think it's impossible to ignore a firelit evening in the woods featured in Rituals and not see it play its hand during Mohawk.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a lot kind of lines up in there, and because the beginning of this film, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Deliverance and John Borman overall. We'll get into that here soon, but at first I was like, okay, so it's like an older group of guys on a similar kind of trip. You know, we're 5 years after, you know, and I started kind of do that kind of thing where I start writing it off. I'm like, okay, so it's Canadian. It's a knockoff of Deliverance. Okay. But it takes once we, you know, they start getting picked off, it's clear. It's a completely different kind of movie. And I don't know. It was just one of those things that I kind of came into the film with the wrong expectations, but was really surprised on how it ended up turning towards the end.
Deliverance itself, you know, while I think we all might you know, tittering, remember, you know, Ned Beatty squealing like a piggy. I mean, the movie is extremely intense, and it's really, really well, I mean, performed. It's like Burt Reynolds is great in it, John Voight's great in it, Ronnie Cox is great in it. Like, the cast slays it in that movie. And but at no point does that film ever really veer into straight horror.
No.
Like, it's a thriller, you know, I mean, and, you know, we can, I think we geeks can draw the line between a thriller film and a horror film. And Deliverance is a thriller, whereas I feel as though Rituals starts out as a thriller and it ultimately descends into a horror film, which I love.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah. And that was just such a strange shift based on, you know, just expectations. Just, you know, being someone who watches a lot of movies, you're like, oh, okay, you kind of figure you've got it pinned. And I was really excited about how it took that turn. And also, you can see a little bit of what may or may not have influence a recent film that was released on Netflix under a very similar title, The Ritual by David Bruckner.
Sure.
So, but yeah.
It's funny when they encounter that slain deer that's, you know, mentioned in the little IMDb blurb that I read. That made me think of the first time in The Ritual, because I just watched that they encounter kind of the weird effigy thing, which I won't say too much more about, because that's a really new movie, so I don't want to ruin it for anyone. But it totally, like, the imagery, I was like, oh, whoa. So it's funny that you bring that up, because I totally, like, that exact moment, and then a lot of other stuff as it went on, I definitely saw was certainly an influence as well. But, you know, interestingly, with this film, I'll be honest, the pacing was a little slow for me. I also think that it was probably because I've had a pretty hellish weekend and I'm trying to catch up on everything I wanted to do earlier in the weekend before I lost electricity. Maybe I was kind of in my own version of the wilderness for a few days in my cold little house. It wasn't a wilderness at all, but I think my mood kind of made this movie a little bit harder to trudge through for me. Because the pacing wasn't necessarily breakneck speed, and I think I struggled with it because of that. But that said, when I sit down and think about it, and as I've been doing, you know, earlier today and yesterday when I watched the film, I definitely see some of the influences from this film in your film, Ted, and I definitely think in the your film's not breakneck speed either. But of course, I went into it with a different mindset, so I think it probably worked for me a lot better in that regard. But I guess I shouldn't show my hand yet and say that I like your movie. Maybe I should be like, oh, leave it suspenseful. But I did like your movie. But that said, this film wasn't really my cup of tea. But it's also a film that I wonder if I go back at with a fresh set of eyes, I might see something completely different. You know.
You know, and I'll be totally honest with you. The first time I saw the film, it didn't quite land with me, and I found that I enjoyed it more on the second viewing because I knew what I was getting into. It was the type of film that, like, I sat down to it fully aware of the adventure I was about to take. And I actually found myself really, really nervous for the first two-thirds of the film, knowing how dark it was going to become. It's kind of like watching Janet Leigh in the first few scenes in Psycho. It's like, it's so intense and scary because you know that girl's about to get killed in the shower. And if you're unaware of that, it feels like a pedestrian drama. But knowing the horrors that are about to come, I think really helps heighten the suspense of the film. I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, you can take that as a plus or a minus in terms of, you know, how you feel in terms of storytelling. Like, you know, should a film be able to land the first time around? Probably, but I'm a big fan of films that have good rewatch value.
No, and I think that's a good way to sum it up, because, like I said before, I had started watching the movie a few times, and I think going into it knowing that I was going to have that slower pace and that I needed to get kind of comfortable and just kind of enjoy what I was going to watch, it really did kind of prep me. I mean, I didn't know about how fucking dark and bleak it was going to get, but once that finally hit, it really did pay off. And yeah, it's probably a movie I'll probably make my way back around to. Probably felt like a summertime movie for me, you know, just being outside and everything. So I'll probably circle back around to it.
Like Mohawk, I think that Rituals is a really good intense matinee.
No, absolutely. I think that's a good way to describe it. I mean, just starting it a little bit earlier and making your way into. So, but yeah, Marcus, I know you haven't seen this for a while, so it's kind of nice to see what you kind of remember and what stuck with you.
Yeah, this. I mean, you know, VHS renting as a kid, like I watched everything, like, you know, didn't matter what it was or who was in it or if, you know, it looked fun. I started going down the line as a kid renting this. So like there are certain things I remember. The deer head stuck out, like that's, you know, I don't know, because it was kind of like a, you know, surprise. You know, like you weren't expecting that, or at least I wasn't. And, you know, so just the image of that. I remember camping. I remember the boots, but not much else about it. So I meant to go back and revisit it. But, yeah, traveling around a lot, like, it's hard because, you know, I don't have.
You have good excuses. It's okay. It's okay.
But, yeah, because I mainly ask because I know in our conversations, you do have a tendency towards the bleak. And so this seemed kind of right up your alley with as nihilistic and as dark as it gets. So I was kind of curious.
Yeah. But I can't remember how it ends. So, like, you know, I mean, okay. I guess if you guys give spoilers.
Spoilers. Can we just say if you haven't seen Rituals, can you, like, take off your headphones for, like, 30 seconds? And
Yeah, I mean, it's only 31 years old, so I think we're pretty good.
So, Marcus, these doctors, these middle-aged doctors go into the woods for this weekend away, unaware of the fact that they're actually being stalked by this guy who had terrible fucked up surgery and is like basically hates doctors. So they chose the absolute worst forest they could possibly go into. And as it progresses, they start getting knocked off. But in the final act of the movie, one of the guys gets tied to a rod and burnt alive. And it is so fucking horrific. And they actually put it on one of the posters. So I feel like it was a spoiler from day one. Or it's one of the VHS covers, maybe. But it starts out with, like, you know, it's like these, you know, these dudes just out there, you know, it's kind of like a bunch of buddies, middle-aged, they all know each other's lives pretty well. And as it progresses, it starts to really be like this, like kind of like Danny Boyle's Shallow Grave, where it's kind of like they start learning things about each other and they're not really cool with it. But they also don't want to see each other die. They're friends. But by the end of this movie, man, these motherfuckers are dead.
Yeah, and man, yeah, that's something we didn't bring up there. I'm glad you did. Is, man, those conversations go from being pretty light, you know, a lot of just like talking shop and, you know, different products they're going to roll out and different, you know, and a lot of just kind of playful banter until, you know, we get to the, you know, the conversations about, you know, the alcoholism and the estrangement and, you know, a character who, you know, which I was pretty surprised at how they portrayed, you know, the gay doctor, you know, in a way that's pretty progressive for 1977. I mean,
extremely progressive. Yeah, like very, like amazing.
Yeah, very matter of fact. Like, you know, because you kind of find out he's gay when he's talking about his boyfriend. I was like, oh, whoa. You know, I kind of rewound it for a second. I was like, 1977 movie about middle-aged doctors. You know, like.
Yeah. So, and it's actually, I mean, it's portrayed in a clever, smart, respectful way. The way, yeah, when that character brings it up, it's a shock to the audience. But everyone else there is so cool with it that I felt like a theater in 1977, I can only imagine the gasps or even like the titters from the audience. And the fact that all of his friends are just like, yeah, whatever, go on. And they just keep talking. You're kind of like, oh, shit. Like, okay, never mind. It's not funny.
Exactly.
Which I'm a big fan of. I mean, there's actually a moment in Mohawk that almost, you know, similarly, where Ezra Buzzington is washing the blood of his son off his body, and he's naked in a river, and it's kind of his, like, Lady Macbeth moment. And similarly, you know, I've seen the film in theaters where it's like people their immediate reaction is to like giggle because it's a butt and butts are funny. And it's like a second later, you're like, oh shit, like this guy's losing his mind and his son just died. And I've been in theaters where it's like you immediately hear the ha and then it stops and suddenly everybody's like wide-eyed and sad and uncomfortable.
Yeah, and it's funny you bring that up because I was actually, when I was watching Mohawk, I was watching it with my mother because we were going to watch the Oscars right after. And she walked in the room and she just started laughing because, you know, it's naked, you know, middle-aged man ass.
It's a butt.
You know, and then she goes, oh, what's, oh, and I'm like, that's his son's, you know, blood. You know, and you could just, it just sucked all the joy out of that moment of laughing yep. at a naked ass.
Sorry for destroying butts, everyone.
Yeah, you ruined it, Ted.
No, man, I still like butts. It's all right. We're good. But, no, in all seriousness, you guys are selling the movie so much that I'm like, man, I definitely need to revisit this. But it's so funny. It didn't sit with me initially, but I think your point's interesting, Ted, that it's a kind of movie that knowing the dread could actually make it that much worse. So I'm starting to get myself ramped up to revisiting it. So I will definitely probably be on a short order for that rather than in a couple years. It might be more like in the next month.
Yeah, man. So no, honestly, it's a good it's an afternoon horror movie, and I say that term with love because I kind of feel that way about Mohawk. Like it's, you know, it's the type of movie, man, 2 p.m. beer, slice of pizza, man, you got yourself some entertainment for 90 minutes.
The trouble with that is I have kids, so 2 o'clock movies are usually like, well, lately they've been Coco over and over, which I can't complain. It's a pretty freaking good movie.
I can't do anything to help you there.
Yeah.
That falls on you, man.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, man. Yeah. Damn it, those kids. But yeah, so with that in mind, let's talk about that second film and just kind of keep rolling here. And the second film you chose was Emerald Forest. Blaine, why don't you give us a little summary of that one?
The Amazon. Mysterious. Powerful. Unchanged since the dawn of time. Until now.
I'm scared.
Here, a child was taken.
Tommy?
Against all odds, Bill Markham searched for his son. An adventure into the darkest regions of a savage wilderness.
At dawn, they caught me.
After 10 years, the journey seems over. But Bill Markham's greatest discovery lies ahead.
Go there!
You know something, don't you?
Yeah.
John Boorman, director of Deliverance and Excalibur, comes an adventure into the hidden places of the earth and of the spirit. The Emerald Forest, based on a true story.
After the son of engineer Bill Markham is abducted by an Aboriginal tribe on the edge of the rainforest, the engineer spends the next 10 years searching for his son. Okay, I just like reading IMDb two-line descriptions. This is a film that I had never seen. I love John Boorman. I'm a big fan of just his strange and bizarre oeuvre of films, you know, that range from, you know, absolute masterpieces like Excalibur and Deliverance to just absolute oddities like Zardoz and Exorcist II, The Heretic. So when you actually suggest this film, I knew I had an idea of the name. I knew Powers Booth was in it, but immediately hopped on Amazon, ordered the DVD, got it, and took me forever to get to it for some reason. Threw it in, and I have to say, Ted, out of all the movies that we've had suggested to us that I had not seen, this is by far my favorite out of all those. This is like...
Oh, that's so awesome to hear.
This is like right up my alley. Definitely different than... Because, I mean, but also I didn't have any expectation. I knew it was John Boorman, so it could be anything from a, you know, a very standard Hollywood drama to absolutely something nearly unwatchable in the best way. And The Emerald Forest, to me, was kind of a combination of the two, where you do have this very straightforward adventure kind of film that's also has these amazing trippy scenes that are, you know, at the time, you know, pretty cutting edge technology that kind of plays a little corny now, but still you can imagine that how those scenes probably played. You know, back in, what was the release date for this? 1985. Yeah, so, yeah, this was something that kind of caught me off guard. I mean, I knew I was going to enjoy watching Powers Booth play, you know, a tough dad, you know, going through and searching for his son. But once we came across, you know, this you know, the tribe, the Fierce, as they're called, this cannibalistic tribe, I don't know, something about it just... It kind of hit all those notes of what I love about these kind of action adventure movies that unfortunately have been cut down, where you don't have a lot of these kind of R-rated, you know, fantastical adventure films. It really kind of brought me back to that era, and like when I was younger, just finding random stuff at the movie store, seeing stuff like Greystone or some of these more, you know, a little bit more adult, a little more violent adventure movies. But I mean, I'll say that I loved this movie. I had a really good time with it. I mean, why did you end up picking this one?
So this film is more visual style than anything. You know, the Emerald Forest, a lot of it takes place during the day. I think the nighttime scenes are obviously very memorable, but the daytime scenes in the film are shot almost exclusively with natural light, which was something that we were really excited to try to explore with Mohawk. Traditionally on films, you do not shoot with natural light because it looks quote unquote fake or like a home movie. But with the right cinematographer and with the right lenses, you can actually turn it into something that, like the title of this film, it looks like an emerald forest. And we wanted to do something really special. Kareem Hussein, my cinematographer on We Are Still Here in Mohawk, took a page from the cinematographer of The Emerald Forest, this gentleman named Philippe Rousselot, who is well known for shooting just absolutely stunning, stunning movies. He back in the 70s, I guess more the 80s, you know, he was doing stuff like Dangerous Liaisons and like Henry and June. And but, you know, as time went by, he did like A River Runs Through It, Summersby, Flesh and Bone, People versus Larry Flint. Like, this is a dude who knows how to shoot movies.
Right.
And he ended up becoming Tim Burton's go-to cinematographer for quite a while. He shot Big Fish, Planet of the Apes, the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory remake. He's a guy who just, he knew what he was doing, and he just shot a hell of a movie with The Emerald Forest. And so we sat down with the film a few days before we started shooting Mohawk. And we just looked at the style in which it was shot, and like the moves, the lack of moves that were made in the film, and how instead of ignoring things like shadows and direct sunlight, like how to embrace those things. And I think we ended up with a very unique visual style, just like The Emerald Forest had. I mean, beyond that, I mean, the movie's just a fucking masterpiece. Like, Powers Booth is so good in it, and Borman's son in it, Charlie Borman, who plays the kid,
he's incredible, man. He's just amazing in this movie.
Yeah. So that's really in a nutshell you know, why I chose this film, because I think visually, stylistically, I think it was the type of backdrop that we desperately wanted for a film like this. I personally feel like most horror films use the forest as a villain. I mean, everything from like Blair Witch Project, even the Ritual recently. It portrays a forest that's dark, foreboding, scary, someplace that you don't want to be. Whereas the Emerald Forest, it's this beautiful, lush, amazing place. And we wanted to capture the forest in Mohawk the same way the forest was captured in the Emerald Forest. We didn't want the forest to seem scary. We wanted the people in the forest to be the real fear, which is totally what Borman did with the Emerald Forest. And hopefully we were able to capture even a portion of that in Mohawk, in that I don't want the forests in Mohawk to feel scary. I want it to feel like paradise. I want it to feel like this amazing, beautiful land where these native people lived and loved for centuries before these shitheads showed up and ruined it. That's the horror, not the forest.
Right. Well, you know what's interesting that you say that is one of the things that makes that. So I guess going into your film Mohawk and into this film, I guess coming out of, you know, Rituals and going right into Emerald Forest, because I watched them pretty much, you know, back to back yesterday and today, I was expecting a darker take on the woods and the forest, so that definitely took me by surprise. And in your film, the same thing. I expected the film to look darker because I know a little bit about you and your films, and just the fact that you're, you know, kind of known as a horror guy. Marcus is a horror guy, you know. And so that doesn't mean that's all you like, but in my head, that's, you know, I'm going into it and thinking that it's going to be a darker thing. And I think one of the things that surprised me immediately about your film, and again, it was very similar in this film, was it didn't feel horror. And a large part of why it didn't feel horror per se, like right away at least, was the fact that it was paradise. It was a gorgeous forest. It was not foreboding in any way. And so I think you accomplished that, because just like in this film and in yours, like, I think it's just the forest doesn't become this creepy looming character of its own. It's more of a gorgeous backdrop for what's going on.
Yeah.
An innocence in a way. Like it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing, you know? And I definitely think you captured that for sure.
Well, I've made several comments about how I feel like Mohawk is a home invasion movie. It's just the home happens to be North America. That these native people were living in this land, and the white man came in and invaded this idyllic home, and you know, basically slathered these beautiful woods in blood. In the same way you look at a film, you know, like, I mean, pick a home invasion movie, From the Strangers to Your Next. It's a very similar conceit. And in those films, I mean, look at any of them. Look at The Strangers. Look at Your Next. Look at Funny Games. The house itself isn't terrifying. The house is a comfortable, nice place where these people live. It's where they love. It is their home. And what makes it scary is that someone has brought this horrible element into their home, which was something that we were trying to capture in Mohawk.
Yeah, and I think you guys do a good job of it, because throughout the Emerald Forest, even when we're taking that trip with Powers Booth, you know, deeper and deeper into the jungle, you feel pretty safe, even though there's so many more dangers. But it's not until, you know, they, you know, once again, spoiler alert, that the remaining tribes people go into the city, that it becomes incredibly stressful. It kind of takes on kind of a horror tone as soon as they kind of make their way across the river, and all of a sudden they're in this, you know, I can't remember which city they're in, but, you know, they're in a major city. Yeah. Going through, you know, the kind of waterside slums and everything. And, I mean, it completely shifts there for about 10 or 15 minutes. And I think in Mohawk you have that kind of similar tone, where it's a, like you said, it's a setting. It's not the villain. It's not like like a few years ago, a film I really enjoyed called The Interior, where literally the forest was like a almost a demonic presence. I like being able to have a story that where you use the backdrop as just the setting rather than some sort of like, you know, evil force. So yeah, no, I think I could definitely see that and definitely appreciate how, you know, both films use that.
Nice. That's exactly what we were going for. We just want folks to be happy, man.
Yeah, man.
You know, and it's interesting. Just what you said there, Blaine, kind of just made me think about. I'm trying to think of how to word it. Of course, now that I'm speaking, I'm having a hard time actually verbalizing what I want to say. But I guess I just think that the people, the tribe that they call the invisible people, right? They seem like the forest to be to kind of be representative a lot of like this innocence, you know.
Sure.
They're uncorrupted, like, you know, good people, and like even when, I mean, this is a huge plot point, but like when the main character Tommy gets kidnapped, they're kidnapping him to protect him. They're not kidnapping him because they want to hurt him. They mm-hmm. think that they're saving him, you know, and it's kind of crazy when you think about that, because they're trying to save him from this modern destruction that's going on, you know, and actually ultimately it sets off this chain of events where like no one knows where he went and he's been kidnapped and, you know, and he doesn't get found for 10 years. But in that 10 years, he's living kind of a nice idyllic life in a lot of ways, you know. So it's kind of just really interesting juxtaposition of our modern, you know, sensibilities versus, you know, kind of that primitive way. And then, of course, like a lot of films do, and I understand why, and I'm glad that these films exist, our way, the modern way, is often vilified in a lot of ways, and it should be, because the main villain, despite the fact that he's awful, cannibalistic tribe, the main villain's really still, you know, these other, you know, human traffickers. So there's a lot of bad, you know, developed, civilized world people out there that are actually what causing this forest and these less corrupt people to be, you know, destroyed.
Yeah, well, I mean, and you've also got to consider the fact that, you know, in Mohawk, you've got a group of basically innocent young Native people who are determined to stay neutral, but ultimately commit an act of extreme violence in Calvin burning down this fort. That is what draws the ire of the new white men. So
it's interesting that in both of these films that's kind of the white man, you know, driving these innocent people to do not so innocent things. Yeah.
I've said repeatedly, Mohawk is a movie about good people making bad decisions and bad people who aren't necessarily totally bad. You know, I mean, no one's going to argue that the white guys in Mohawk aren't the bad guys, but they're confused and they have no idea what they're doing a lot of the time, which, you know, makes the movie sadly very timely. I mean, I don't necessarily think the majority of America is evil, but I do think the majority of America is confused and not quite aware of the decisions they're making. I mean, I think that the tribe, the invisible people in the Emerald Forest, they're these beautiful, idyllic people living these amazing lives. But when Bill brings that journalist into their village, they fucking murder him. And it's like...
That's true, yeah.
It's horrifying. And so you have these moments of like, holy shit. Like, this is some scary shit in that... You don't know who these people are. They might lead these magical lives, but they also they are strangers. And I think that fear of the unknown is what drives Holt in Mohawk to commit these atrocities. All Holt in Mohawk knows is that a Native American burnt down his fort, and because of that, he is not going to stop until every Native American person is dead. It's very similar to, you look at something like post 9/11, you had all of these people who were like, you know, Muslims destroyed the World Trade Center. All Muslims are evil. We need to destroy them. And no one was capable of, one, noting the difference between radical people and average folk, but they also were completely incapable of acknowledging the fact that sometimes violent acts occur as responses to pre-existing violent acts. Does that mean the violent act is okay? Far from it. It's still an absolute atrocity, but people make poor decisions based on poor decisions. That's how war works. It's revenge after revenge after revenge, which we see a bit in the Emerald Forest, and we certainly see a lot of in Mohawk.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that we can kind of use this to transition even right into Mohawk.
They're going
to
kill us all if we don't fight.
We are in a valley surrounded by a ridge. To the north, there's a river. To the east, there's a war. You will not live to see tomorrow. Not because of what you did, because of who you are.
We need to move. Oksa!
I want the demons to leave and I will fight.
They're over there!
We are advancing with speed after the enemy.
Now we have to get back and tell the people we're at war.
So if I were to allow one more of your kind
to kill
one more white man,
you could not face my lord on Judgment Day.
Aren't you worried about her? Being out here in the woods all alone?
No, but you should be.
We should have never come here.
This is our home.
Then your home will burn.
Kenzie! You won't stop it!
There's something in these woods!
This is Mohawk land. We're in their house.
I think it's just kind of natural here. We've already kind of touched on a lot of stuff from it, but you know, if I can step back from the story itself for just a few minutes and say or ask just maybe a little bit of a history of this project and how it came about.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mohawk was a concept that I was very interested in for many, many years. I grew up in rural Montana, and I was around Blackfoot and Cherokee people a lot growing up. And when I moved to New York 10 years ago, I was very surprised upon moving to Manhattan just how few Native people I saw on the streets or in my daily life. And at the same time, as I walked around Manhattan, I noticed all these signs everywhere that would say Mohawk Construction or built with Mohawk iron. And I was very curious as to what that meant. The only thing I really knew the word Mohawk for was Marcus's haircut. and so I started looking up, and I was aware of the fact that the Mohawk were an indigenous people of North America, but I knew nothing else about them. So I started reading up on them and just discovering how incredible these people were from, you know, all that they'd endured from the first colonialization of North America through the War of 1812 through what they're going on now and the Oka crisis that occurred in 1990. These were people who had just seen this like insurmountable sort of aggression from outsiders, and they never stopped. And I thought, wow, that's an amazing story. And it always just hung out in the back of my skull, and we ended up making We Are Still Here. And afterward, the folks at Dark Sky Films and Snowfort Pictures were willing to take a chance on a film that was substantially more unconventional than We Are Still Here, and they went for Mohawk. So I delivered them a very angry, very political, very anti-Trump film that is exactly the sort of story that I felt like needed to be told in 2017-2018. While on set, we kept joking we're making a movie for Trump's America, never actually expecting that to become a reality. But given the world that we live in right now, I'm very pleased that we have a film about marginalized people stepping up against the oppressive people who make their lives shitty. But I am also aware of the weight that carries given everything that's going on in the world. So we have an unfortunately timely movie.
And kind of
that's totally fair.
Right, absolutely. And to kind of touch on what you're talking about before we got into Mohawk, I do think it's interesting because with being such a politically charged film, I do like that you give depth to these people, to these white invaders that are coming through, to where multiple times it's mentioned, like, why don't we just leave? Why? You know, where, because I mean, with a lot of these people who are voting this way and kind of propagating this this kind of hate speech, there has to be a part in their mind that says, I don't really know why we're going to this extent. And
well, and you know, for me, it's the sort of thing where if you look at Holt and his men in Mohawk, Holt is a very confused man who is completely acting based on reaction.
Right.
He doesn't have a single idea in his head that's birthed out of anything other than reaction. This is a man who has spent most of his life indoctrinated by politics and religion to make him believe that he is the master race and that everything he is doing is right. I mean, we've got these guys wandering around now wearing their Make America Great Again shirts, but Holt and his men in Mohawk, they're the guys who were out there trying to make America great the first time. And they did that by murdering the indigenous people. So you've got these people who all they can believe is that if the white man is successful, the country will be successful. And that's unfortunately exactly what's happening right now in America. You know, as soon as Trump unveiled his Make America Great Again campaign, I thought, no, you just want to make America white again. You're terrified of all of the skin tones that are wandering around this country right now. And you're going to hide behind thinly veiled racism in order to prove your point. And that's exactly the points that we were touching on in Mohawk somehow before they actually occurred in reality.
Yeah, and that's incredibly unfortunate that this wasn't given the chance to be an alternate reality rather than what we're, you know, currently, you know, enduring. And I mean, what was kind of the tone when you were putting together? Because I take it, you know, based on what you said, was before the election results. I mean,
So we shot this during the campaign. It was shot a year ago last summer, so about a year and a half ago. It's a little over, but it was written knowing the direction that the country was headed in. We were seeing the rise of nationalism again. We were seeing very open racism, and we were seeing marginalized people, whether people of color, the LGBT community, any number of people whose lives are already pretty shitty, being treated even worse. And that's something that I couldn't help but address. I knew that, you know, We Are Still Here was a love letter to the horror movies that I grew up adoring. And I wanted to make a movie that was about something that was important to me. So I made We Are Still Here. After that, I started realizing that even though horror films are very important to me, the shit that's going on in this country and in the world is even more important to me. So how do I combine all this? And the result is this very angry, very political film that, yes, it has shades of Rituals, shades of Emerald Forest and Ravenous and Friday the 13th and countless other movies. But at its core, it's a movie about what's happening in 2018 because we didn't address it
the first time. So I hope, if anything, people who watch Mohawk can go, okay, I get it. This shit just keeps happening. How do we stop it from happening?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that's made pretty clear throughout the film without it, but on the other side, it's not being ham-fisted. So anyone listening out there, it's a subtlety that's very smart, and you know, and I think that really pays off in the film. One thing I wanted to mention, just because you had mentioned it before, I know that you had Karim Hussein shoot both work as cinematographer on both We Are Still Here as well as Mohawk. How did you two kind of connect? Because I'm a big fan of Subconscious Cruelty and really enjoy his work. Not to kind of veer in that end, but I was just kind of curious how you two linked up and what the process was like shooting this film, just because both films have a very distinct style, and kind of wanted to discuss that.
My day job, as I'm sure a lot of listeners may know, is I'm a film publicist. My job is to spread the good word about other people's movies, and the majority of films that I work on are horror and science fiction. I'm a genre film publicist, and many, many years ago, I was a publicist for Jason Eisner's Hobo with a Shotgun, upon working on, I discovered that Kareem shot. So I was very, very close with the project through its world premiere and release, and I became quite close with Jason, the producer, Bob, and Kareem. And Kareem at the time was living in Montreal, Quebec, and I was also working as the publicist for the Fantasia Film Festival. So I would pop up to Fantasia and assist at that festival, and Kareem was always up there. So we became close, very quick, very close friends. And as the years went by, I said, boy, if I ever get the opportunity to make a movie, it would be incredible if Kareem could shoot it. I'm a huge fan of his. I mean, not only from Hobo, but the first season of Hannibal. I mean, the guy shot stuff that I think is just absolutely jaw dropping. And so I thankfully was able to work with him. His schedule lined up, and he was eager to work with a friend. And we shot We Are Still Here together. When the opportunity came to make Mohawk, I reached out to him and told him, I've got this really cool screenplay about this young Mohawk woman who goes through all this shit during the War of 1812. And Kareem said, hey, have you cast the Mohawk woman yet? And I said, well, no, I just finished the screenplay. And Kareem tells me, well, I directed a segment of a horror anthology called The Theater Bazaar a few years ago. His segment was called Vision Stains, the highlight of the whole film.
Right.
And Kareem said, the young actress that I worked with on my segment in The Theater Bazaar is actually a Mohawk, and she's incredible. You should meet her. So lo and behold, Kareem introduces me to Ganya Dio Horn, who ended up playing Oak in Mohawks. It's kind of interesting how these bridges are built.
No, that's awesome. Because he does kind of have the highlight film of that of the theater bazaar. Oh, yeah, because that's, I mean, it's got a few interesting ones. I know that they were going to finally do a sequel to that, but I guess it fell through. But moving over to Marcus a little. Hey, Marcus.
I was going
to
say that's such a good hook into Marcus, because
yeah.
although I love Kareem's segment in the Theater Bazaar, you ain't ever getting better than the effects that Marcus threw into that movie, because they are amazing.
Exactly. Yeah. So I want to ask you kind of about working on the effects on Mohawk, as well as working with Ted on these last few projects.
Mohawk definitely gets bloody. We were allowed to, you know, go kind of excessive. Because we're outdoors, we can make a mess anywhere. So that kind of helped. And when we shot We Are Still Here, of course, the house was in repair and remodel. So again, you know, something that always happens to me is like, oh, we've got this bloody story, lots of effects, and then we get to a location and can't shoot the effects the way they were intended or written because we can't get blood on anything. And, you know, both We Are Still Here and Mohawk, like none of that was hampered. You know, Kat and I had carte blanche to, you know, make things as bloody as we could. Or I haven't seen the Mohawk cut yet. I'm waiting for the DVD because I like to buy everything physical copies.
What?
Yeah, I mean, you guys have seen it, so you know what's in there. And, you know, Ted, is there anything cut from the film that we may have done?
Nope, all your splatter's in there. So,
yeah, fun with, you know, hunting knives, fun with arrows, fun with, you know, old musket guns.
Oh, yeah, and those arrow wounds are pretty brutal, because that's one thing I've in a lot of your films is I always kind of tell your style with it always being kind of a very really gross and real kind of feeling, wounds and things like that. I've always praised it because I still think it's probably one of the best exploding head scenes on your work on We Are Still Here. That shotgun to the face could be one of my favorite exploding heads. How did you guys end up pulling that off in that house?
Again, because it was the owners of the home were like repairing and rebuilding stuff. So it didn't matter if we got blood on the walls. Our fantastic art crew would go in and re things overnight, literally, you know, because films are shot out of order. And so we'd have to make bloody messes on every wall, you know, for the end sequence. And then the next day we were shooting something prior to that happening. Mm-hmm. So we'd go in and everything had been cleaned. They'd stayed all night repainting. But the head, yeah, the head though, that was a funny day, because I remember that one in particular. Hussein was totally egging me on, because, you know, he's about, I don't know, 10 feet away from the head prop. And he's, him and Ted are just like, so Marcus, what are we doing here? Are we making a PG film? Like, is this Twilight? You know, of course, we let it rip. And he's, you know, bagged up, you know, camera, everything's like completely coated, because he is in direct fire for the blood cannon. And
he's right behind it.
Yeah, and nailed him. It was beautiful.
Yeah, because that is one of the most gnarliest effects. I remember first time I watched it, I literally cheered when I saw that head explode. So, but no, that's awesome. But Justin, you still there, man?
I'm still here, man. I'm just enjoying the conversation. I haven't listened to you guys geek out. It's a good time.
And, you know, the cast of Mohawk was fantastic to work with. Did some life casting, so, you know, there's not so much as body parts, but, you know, some people get hurt in plenty of places. There is one. I don't want to give anything away, so I'm going to remain a little silent. But yeah.
Someone got a life cast of the head.
Yeah.
Yes. And there's one big one in the movie that I don't want to bring up because it is so much fun, but you don't really get to see it until the last few moments. So for our fans out there, our listeners out there that are big fans of gore, don't worry, you get a pretty good payoff towards the end, because kind of bouncing back to you, Ted, was I wanted to kind of talk about going from making a horror film, you know, an indie horror film, into kind of moving into making a period piece. I mean, what was kind of the discussion going into that? Because it's you know, just seeing Dark Sky, knowing your background. I mean, what kind of got you deciding to do this? I mean, outside of getting what was going on with Trump, but kind of moving towards doing a period piece, which is kind of unheard of if you don't have $1 zillion.
It's kind of funny you say that, because it does have to do with Trump, in that We Are Still Here, that in 1979, 1980, it's kind of an ambiguous era. I always tell people, I'm like, We Are Still Here is set during my childhood, a time when things were happier, things were simpler. And yes, unfortunately, ancient evils wake up under houses and kill people, but it was simpler times. And I myself am a big fan of simpler times. So after We Are Still Here came out, the opportunity to make Mohawk popped in. I was very keen on the idea of directing a film that was set in a wildly different time, but also a time that is unfortunately not unlike our own. So to set a movie 204 years ago and go, boy, not a whole lot has changed, was the conceit behind that. And I will tell you that the new film that I am working on is also going to be a period piece. My goal was for the first three films that I direct to all be set outside of reality in terms of time. So I wanted my first three films to all be period pieces. So the new one is definitely not going to be set in the present either, because I just want to get the fuck out of here.
That is totally, totally fair, man. That is totally fair. I think a lot of us share that sentiment. I guess
fuck out of this.
What I find interesting too about this film being a reaction to the Trump stuff and the bullshit we're living in, is that subtle enough that those who don't know it's about that probably still enjoy the film, even if they're Trumpers. And I bring that up because my father-in-law I showed the film to, and he is a little bit of a Trumper. A little bit. I will say a little bit, because he's not a full-fledger. I have a hard enough where he's at, to be honest. I'm still reconciling that. By the time I reconcile that, hopefully Trump is long and gone. But I bring it up because the film itself, if you have somebody who's relatively and how they watch films, they can still enjoy this film as a pure film.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you know, I'm a very political person, and I'll use any opportunity I have to tell you my agenda. But any filmmaker, any artist, anyone who doesn't say that is completely full of shit. We all have agendas. We all want the world to be a certain way.
It's so true.
Yeah. We're all totally trying to do it. I'm being a little more obvious about it. And the truth of the matter is, like, at the end of the day, yes, I have an agenda, but I also want to make a movie that's entertaining. I want to make something that people can enjoy sitting down to, because no one's going to watch it if it's just going to be like, oh, cool, it's an Inconvenient Truth 3. Like, I get it. Like, if it's 100% political agenda, nobody's going to bite. But if it's political agenda wrapped within something exciting, yeah, they're totally going to go for it. I mean, the perfect example is George Romero. Everything he did was a socio-political masterpiece. And, you know, he hid that guise of entertaining genre fare. It's like Night of the Living Dead. It's about the breakdown of the American family. Dawn of the Dead is his angry cry against consumerism. And I love that as a kid. To me, like, I was so excited about the fact that I could see these messages in zombie movies. I thought I was Roger Ebert. I thought I was the smartest, like, film I was the smartest guy on earth, because I understood why the zombies were going to the mall. If you took that away, man, that movie is still great. Like, and the perfect way to explain that is the Zack Snyder's remake of Dawn of the Dead, which takes out all of the socio-political commentary, is still super fun. So
we actually covered that film on the podcast. We made very clear comments right there. It's kind of funny.
It's like you take all the politics out of it, and it's still totally kick ass. And I'd like to believe that if you take all the politics out of Mohawk, you've still got a really entertaining yarn. That said, the politics are the driving factor. They were the driving factor for Romero. They are probably, at least for the foreseeable future, going to be the driving factor behind any horror film that I make.
Oh, and that's totally fair. And, you know, and I think a lot of the best things that happen in genre film are driven that way, at least as far as the stuff that I'm really drawn to. So maybe you're just speaking to the choir in this regard. But I definitely agree with you there. I yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's starting to show it more in the mainstream. I mean, you know, we're recording this in 2018, so if those people listen to this in the future, the Oscars just happened, and I mean, Get Out just won a fucking Oscar, which
in a major, in one of the major awards, you know, one of the major awards. So, you know, it's big.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, best original screenplay. That's nothing to scoff at. That society might be catching up more with these tones that you're seeing in horror films. And like you said, between people like Romero and countless others, you can see that message in there when you're looking for it, but while still providing a really good quality film that even if you remove it, you're still going to enjoy it. But there's something more important, something that makes things a little bit more timeless. If there is that message that can be applied to, you know, I mean, human beings are going to be shitty no matter what. So having that message in there just kind of keeps that film, you know,
I never thought that a year ago when I sat down to watch Get Out, you know, which is ultimately a horror version of The Stepford Wives meets Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And features someone having their head basically torn from their shoulders with deer antlers, a la Silent Night, Deadly Night. Like I never in a million years would have thought this is going to win Best Screenplay at the Oscars, but it totally deserves it because it's so witty, it's so smart, and it so succinctly wraps up everything that's going on right now. From Black Lives Matter to Me Too to all of the sort of movements that are happening right now. It's like you've got this wacky comedian from Comedy Central writing poignant social commentary that just slays, and it also happens to have people getting stabbed in the fucking head. Like, that's awesome. And for me, it's super unconventional that it won an Oscar, but I can't think of a better film to win an Oscar. Like, that is the best screenplay of the year.
Absolutely. I mean, it's to me, that was the movie of 2017.
Yep.
If you were to wrap up that year in a movie, that was it. And hopefully, you know, things are going to keep changing and moving that direction, because I love the fact that a young black director took home an Oscar on his first film by making a horror film that I'm sure in 20, 30 years from now, people are going to be able to still pull things out that are happening in, you know, 2048. The same shit. To me, it has that feeling like a good Alfred Hitchcock film, where every time I watch Vertigo, there's something there that you can take away from. I was just very excited to see that. I know a lot of people are too cool for school when it comes to the Oscars, but I love fucking movies. So I watch this shit.
I'm an Oscar watcher myself.
I'm not, but that's because of any kind of like high horse. I don't do award shit all that much, and I instead I watched Battle Royale last night. So,
no, that's awesome. Well, with that said, I guess
I mean, there's so many things we could talk about. With Mohawk, that, you know, you guys had not only a great cinematographer with you, you know, that you talked about, Kareem Hussain, but honestly, my favorite composer in the genre world right now did your soundtrack. So
yeah, I mean, don't worry, you don't have to say his name. I will. I'm assuming you're referring to Wojciech Kluski.
Yeah, and that's why I just figured you'd handle it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I figured if I said the composer, I'd have no idea how. I've been listening to his music for a couple of years, like the stuff he's done, both the stuff he put up on his like solo stuff on Bandcamp that he just does, you know, for himself, and all the soundtrack stuff, and I not once even tried to pronounce that out loud. So yeah,
Wojciech, just say Wojciech, you're good to go.
Wojciech, because like, there's no other Wojciech out there right now. Yep. Doing this, so fair.
Awesome. Except for that other Wojciech.
Oh, man. The other Wojciech's so mad at me right now.
No, that's awesome. And one thing we have not mentioned is that Mohawk is available right now on VOD.
Damn right.
It's pretty much available everywhere. Vudu, Amazon, all those good places for you guys to rent. I mean, as we go out, I mean, Ted, where can everybody find you on the social media?
You can find me at Ted Gagan. It's super hard to spell, but it goes T-E-D-G-E-O. G-H-E-G-A-N. Or you can just type in Mohawk Ted and it will probably show up. Or just look up We Are Still Here on the IMDb. So, as far as Mohawk right now, it is available on virtually every streaming on-demand service. I realize that podcasts last forever, but if you are listening to this within the next month, the movie does appear on all major cable streaming platforms on April 1st. Got a good couple weeks from our recording until it shows up on your Comcast and Spectrum. But until then, you can grab it on iTunes, Vudu, any of those wonderful places. And I believe a DVD and Blu-ray is coming out in a couple months as well if you want to have physical media.
Like physical media, Marcus, exactly. Yeah, Blaine and I just read each other's minds. Marcus, since you said you're the physical media guy, I want to give you this opportunity. You need to plug anything you're working on and where folks can stay on top of what's going on with you.
Right now, prepping for a film shooting in Virginia, Johnny Z, kind of an action zombie film, kind of cartoony. I don't know. It should be a lot of fun. I mean, the script's fun. So, and it's directed by the guy, Jonathan Stratham, Straighten, did Night of Something Strange. So that's the next big project I'm gearing up to go work on. I'm on Facebook and Instagram, so usually the top one coming up, MARCOS and then KOH. So that's the best awesome. Places to find.
Fantastic. Well, thank you guys both for coming on the show. I just want to let everybody know that Buried Alive Film Festival, we are now taking submissions. So make sure that if you are a filmmaker that you're sending me all your shit on Film Freeway at Buried Alive Film Festival. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show and talking about some of your favorite movies as well as Mohawk. Once again, Mohawk is available on all streaming platforms, Vudu, Amazon Prime, all that good shit. So thank you guys so much, and we'll see you next time. Peace.